I did not know that you were going to read from 1 Peter 4, but that's such an appropriate text to consider before our thinking about the life of Hansard Nahlas, because he certainly was one of those that was persecuted and felt the reproach of Christ, and yet in his life was able to glorify Christ. And so we want to definitely look at individuals like that throughout our history to be encouraged by their lives and be strengthened for the way that we are to live out our lives before God in the world in which we live. I've chosen for a title for this time today, Christ Exalted in the Harried Life of Hansard Nahlas. And I need to explain the title a little bit. We're going to be looking at the life of this man, Hansard Nahlas, that lived throughout most of the 17th century. We're going to talk about his dates in just a few moments. He was a contemporary of people like William Kiffin and Benjamin Keach, and was one of the more useful, one of the more influential Baptists during the 17th century. And yet, in our day, many people do not know who this man was. So there's a reason why we should look at the life of Hansard Nahlas. Secondly, part of the title is the harried life of Hansard Nahlas. And just to help you out, because I need these helps every once in a while, I looked up the definition of harried, because it's not a word that we use very much. I just thought it was very alliterative that worked with Hansard. But there was a reason for it. Harried, feeling strained as a result of having demands persistently made on one. Harassed. Now, many of us may feel like that at times, especially the first part, feeling strained as a result of having demands persistently made on one. Many of us feel demands and feel what it's like to feel the restraints because of that. But not all of us feel harassed while we're going through that. The meaning of harried kind of brings the two of those things into play as we think about someone who was persecuted as he's feeling the strains of the demands of life. And so we're looking at the harried life of Hansard Nahlas. And then the first part of the title, Christ Exalted. I'm only going to reference this just a little bit now, and I'm going to deal with it in the middle of the work and at the end. But there was a title of one of the sermons of Nahlas called Christ Exalted, and there's a fuller title that we'll look at in a little bit. And I wanted to reference this in the title because I think this is the key to Hansard Nahlas' life. It's the reason that he could withstand the persecutions and the reproaches and the imprisonments and everything else that he went through throughout his life. It was because he had an understanding of what we dealt with last night and what we just heard about, of the covenant of grace. He understood this. He knew that the Lord had called him to this, even to a life of suffering. And yet in all of those things, his supreme desire was to see Christ exalted. So Christ Exalted in the Harried Life of Hansard Nahlas. Have any of you ever heard of Nahlas, by the way? Only a few hands. Well, hopefully you will leave a little bit more informed. I remember a number of years ago, seems like an eternity ago, when I gave my first major paper on Benjamin Keach. And I remember starting the paper by quoting a scripture reference that I had read that morning from my McShane's Bible readings. I don't even remember the exact reference at this point, but it was something to the effect where it was dealing with a very short passage of scripture in the Old Testament about someone that I can guarantee none of you in this room have ever heard of, even if you've read McShane's daily Bible readings. It's just one of those people in the Old Testament we don't ever think about. And I remember saying after reading that before the group of people there to listen about the paper about Keach, I said, I hope that we know more about Benjamin Keach when we get through than what we know about this man in the Old Testament. And I'll say that about Hansard Nahlas this morning. I hope when we get through that we know a little bit more about this man than what you do as of right now. First of all, a little bit about his name. It's certainly an unusual name, Hansard. That part of his name seems to have come from his mother's side of the family and was borrowed as part of her maiden name. The Knollys part, K-N-O-L-L-Y-S, is up for debate. That's the way most people think about Hansard, his last name. It can be spelled K-N-O-W-L-E-S, and therefore it looks like Knowles, or possibly no less. There's about, I don't know, seven or eight pretty major different ways to spell his last name and or to pronounce it three or four different ways. But most all people today will reference it as Knollys or Knollys. You'll hear me saying Knollys the majority of the time because that's just the way that I've learned it. So Hansard Knollys. Let's talk a little bit about his birth. And what I want to do is divide the rest of our time together up into really three major categories: his life, his labors, and his legacy. Life, labors, and legacy. So his life, I want to think for a few moments just about his early life, when he was born, his parents, and the early part of his life. He was born in a little small village of Caukwell in Lincolnshire. It's, as they say, on the road from Lincoln to Horncastle near the town of Louth. And I'm sure all of you know exactly where that is. His parents were Richard and Rachel Knollys. Richard was an Anglican clergyman of the parish in Lincolnshire and seems to have been a very godly man. Was desirous to train up his children, including Hansard, in the way of Christ. Was a godly man, a loving father, and had an extremely fine influence on Hansard as a young man. He also saved Hansard, not in the salvific way, but he saved him from death. When Hansard was six, he fell into the water and was drowning, and his father dived in after him and pulled him out and resuscitated him, kept him alive. So you can imagine the son always looked up to his father and respected him, and was appreciative that he had given him life. His mother seems to have been a very godly woman and also had a very fine influence on him as well. We don't really know exactly when he was born. If you look at almost all of the textbook references to him, it will say 1598 or 1599. And there were some calendar issues back then. But they'll put a little question mark by that because we're not told exactly what year he was born. We know that he died in 1691, so a long time into the 17th century. If he was born in 1598 or 99 and he lived to 1691, then he's 92, 93, 94 years old, depending how your calendar works. And because at the end of his autobiography, which he did not finish, but his friend William Kiffin finished for him, Kiffin references that he was 93 years old when he died. Now, recently, in one of the major books, scholarly books about Knollys by Dennis Buston. And by the way, I recommend these two books more than anything else, Paradox and Perseverance, Hansard Knollys, Particular Baptist Pioneer in 17th Century England by Dennis C. Buston, and Erroneous and Schismatical Opinions, The Question of Orthodoxy Regarding the Theology of Hansard Knollys by Barry H. Howson. I told Todd earlier I had sent a note to Michael Haken, such a wonderful Baptist historian, and simply asked him, what books would you recommend? This was after I'd done all my studies, but I thought, have I missed something? And he immediately messaged me back and said, these two books. And I said, okay, I'm on the right page anyway. They really are the best scholarly works. There are a number of other lesser tomes, things like the British Particular Baptist series. Volume 1 deals with Hansard Knollys. It happens to be an article by, guess who? One of these same guys. Barry Howson. And it's a very fine article. You can also find articles like this on online. Nettles deals with Hans Renales in one of his books. So there are a number of contemporary resources to deal with it. I personally, in addition to these wonderful academic works, I have found his autobiography to be the most helpful to fill in a lot of the dates. And I'm going to be reading from that autobiography often as we go through his life. Most of these scholars will have to go back and reference that because that's the most authoritative understanding that we have about his life. He wrote it himself. But Buston deals with the possibility that he wasn't born in 1598 or 1599, but that he was born in 1609. And the reasons that he gives for this is, first of all, because of his parents and the particular moves that they made, and it looked like that, and we don't have specific records for this, but it looks like his parents were married at the beginning of 1609, and at the end of 1609 that he was born, because on November the 13th of 1609, he's baptized. So that would just kind of make sense. And then there are some other reasons that you can back into it and look by implication that he might have been born of that. One of the portraits, there's only two portraits of him. One of the portraits that we have of Knollys is it says that he was 67 years old when it was done. And if you do the math based on some things there, you would have to look at it being that he was probably born 1609 or 1610. So there's a pretty compelling argument that everybody that ever wrote about him up until this century had it wrong, and that Buston has figured it all out, and he was really born in 1609. The only other compelling argument contra to that is the autobiography with William Kiffin's notes at the end, because at the end, when William Kiffin is making comment about Knollys' life, he references, "I've known him personally for 54 years, and he says this man died at 93. Well, if anybody's going to know how old the guy is, you would think it'd be a friend that's known him for 54 years. So that's pretty compelling, too. So I'll leave it to you scholars here to decide when he was actually born. It only affects the things at the beginning of his life that we look at as far as determining times and dates. That's really the only compelling thing is at the beginning of his life. So he's baptized in 1609, November the 13th. He is primarily homeschooled, which was common for the time. He did have a very intellectual father who was well-read as a clergyman. And the father had hired out tutors. He had a couple of different tutors at young age from 10 and up. He had secular and religious instruction, especially in the classical languages. I was talking to my brother Shane today about classical languages, Latin and Greek, and he was also trained in a little bit of Hebrew. So if you're 10 to roughly 16 and you're studying Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, which was common, again, for the time to do that in this day, he would have been very bright, and he seems to have picked up languages very well. We'll come back to more of that in a minute. When he's 15, he moves to a town not far away called Scartho, primarily because his father had just been appointed the Anglican rector not far from Colquhoun in this town of Scartho. Not long after this, probably somewhere between 16 and 17, he went to Cambridge. Now, this is very unusual because most of our 17th century Baptists were not university trained. Okay, so this is one of the ones that did have a very fine, serious education. So he went to Cambridge, where the Puritans who were teaching there influenced him in his theology and a desire for a pure church. It is most likely, we're pretty sure that we have proof on this, that Richard Sibbes was one of his teachers. We're pretty sure that some of his classmates were people like John Arrowsmith and, more better known, Thomas Goodwin. So he was in pretty good field of people while he was at Cambridge at a young man. He was in 1626, he's made master of St. Catherine's, and in 1627, he graduates, he matriculates at St. Catherine's Hall. This also helps us to try to figure out if you want to take the 1609-1610 birth date, because most of the people who graduated or matriculated from Cambridge did so between 16 and 18. And if you subtract 16 or 18 from 1627, you get the 1609-1610 date. So there is some work for you to do mathematically there. In 1629, he graduates from Cambridge. He's appointed master of Gainsborough Free School. Now, this is important because the early part of his life, as soon as he gets out of Cambridge, he spends teaching. He's a teacher. And this is going to come up over and over again throughout his life. He was a very brilliant linguist, and he was teaching the same kind of education he got himself. It was a classical education, and in that classical education, part of it was grounded in the languages. So he would have taught Greek, Latin, and probably Hebrew. So he goes to this Gainsborough Free School, and while there he becomes acquainted with an elderly, pious widow who helped him in the Christian walk and put him in touch with a nonconformist. Now, that would have been unusual because, again, his family is Anglican. So this is like one of the first nonconformists that he has contact with, and seems to really challenge him about his Christian walk and start challenging about some of his views. Also in 1629, he becomes pensioner at Catherine Hall, which just means he's teaching there. He's working there at the school itself. In June 29th of 1629, he's ordained as a deacon in the Church of England. And the very next day, and this would have been kind of unusual, June 30th, 1629, he's ordained as a presbyter. So now he is able, by the bishop, to begin to teach and to preach, and is very shortly appointed in the local parish in Humberstone. Just 2 years later, 1631, he meets his future wife, Anne Cheney, and they marry. And it seems to be about this same time, 1631, right after they married, that he begins to think about what he's doing as a minister in the Church of England. And there's some things that bother him for what he has to do as a minister. For example, there's the use of the cross at baptism. That bothered him. There was things about the indiscriminate admission of people to the Lord's Supper. It seemed like anybody could come to the Lord's Supper. That bothered him. That means he's really beginning to think through, what does church membership look like? And he's beginning to work through, it needs to be a regenerate church membership. Does that sound baptistic? It certainly sounds independent and congregational. So there are some changes that are beginning to take place at this point in 1631. So much so that he pulls away and has some real soul struggle and determines that he shouldn't be preaching if he doesn't have a clear sense of what he's doing, and especially of God's call to the ministry. So he begins to spend a lot of time in prayer and seeking the counsel from the Lord and asking what he needs to do. He hears about a man that's in a little village nearby named John Wheelwright, who was a Puritan. And after struggling earnestly in prayer for a few days and reading through a couple of portions in Isaiah 43 and Isaiah 54, it says he has a little bit of a breakthrough. And he ends up going to see Wheelwright and tells him what's been going on, the struggles have been going on, but that he's got a little bit of a breakthrough, personally speaking. And Wilright says, well, basically, you weren't really a true believer before this. And he goes on in his own autobiography to say, I really just had a formal religion. I had sat under the ministry of some godly men. I had heard the gospel. When I went to Cambridge, I heard some godly preachers. I learned and I have the gifts to do all these things, but everything was formal. It wasn't real. It wasn't spiritual. And now he feels like that God has really come and spoken to him. And after Wilright tells him, go back and spend some time waiting upon the Lord and praying some more. After a little time, he really does feel like God has called him. And from then on, he feels like that he has gotten the blessing of the Lord. Up to that point, no matter how many times he had preached, which was a lot already, he had never seen an actual conversion. But from this point on, he feels like the Lord has blessed him, and he begins to see people coming to faith in Christ, and there's real faith and real spiritual growth, and he believes now God has indeed called him to the ministry, and he believes that he's going to be useful for the sake of God. In 1636, there is persecution that begins to start. In 1633, if you know anything about British history, it's when William Laud becomes Archbishop of Canterbury, and he puts some major stress on all the nonconformists and basically says, you have to conform to what we're saying that you must do. And obviously the nonconformists are saying, no, we're not. And so many of them, as they were discovered for their nonconformity, were then arrested and imprisoned. So here's the first time that the Court of High Commission arrests him. And as he's going to take him away to put him in jail, Knollys, miraculously it almost seems, persuades the man who arrested him to release him. It seems like the more that he talked this guy, the guy had some pangs of conscience about what he had done in turning him over. And so now he says, I want to set you free. And so he allows him to get away instead of going to jail. So he, Knollys goes back, he picks up his wife. They just had a young baby, and they go to the port side and they have to wait for a pretty good while before they can get on a ship. And then they flee to New England to get away from the persecution. Now, all of you probably read stories about what it was like to cross over the waters during this time in the 1600s. It is horrific. If you read the autobiography at this point, you almost get sick at your stomach just listening to him describe what it's like. The waves that would come upon the ship, how everything was spoiled, how the cheese was spoiled that they're supposed to eat, how the crackers were moldy with green stuff on them. He's very specific in all the language. How his young wife with their first baby dies. Not the wife, but the baby dies because of the horrific things on board. This all happens on the way over there to New England. He's also had to spend all of his money that he had before he left, and his wife has having to use most of the money that she had to get the ticket to go over to England. So when they arrive in New England and they arrive in Boston, they arrive almost penniless. Now, one of the things that you'll see in the life of Knollys is the work of God's providence at work. Because over and over and over again, Knollys will give thanks to God for how the Lord provided. And so when he gets to New England, there are some people that say, oh, you need a place to stay? No problem. Okay? Stay there as long as you want? No problem. But he doesn't have any money, so he's got to work. So he says, for a long period of time, I worked with my hoe. So we get this picture of him doing manual labor with a hoe, just trying to make enough money, but at least they've got a place to stay. His wife has really had a tough time, but they are able to move on. He meets in New England, his old friend John Wheelwright. And you think, another sweet providence of the Lord. But it was not. Because Wheelwright, along with a number of the people, like Ann Hutchison, does that name ring a bell to any of you? Ann Hutchison and Wheelwright and a number of people had just been condemned for their antinomianism, which was a major issue in 17th century New England. And they were being sent back. They were being banished from New England because of the connection between Knollys and Wheelwright. Then guess what happens to Knollys? Everybody assumes he's antinomian. And so they begin to attack him and persecute him. And even people like the governor of Massachusetts, who was John Winthrop, in Winthrop's journals, he makes reference of Knollys and makes reference of what kind of man he is and that he's being accused of these things. So he's labeled an antinomian for holding, quote, some of Mrs. Hutchinson's opinions. And it looks like he's going to be arrested for this once again. But in God's providence, here come a couple of guys just happened to be in Boston here for the week or whatever. And they come up to him. They discover that he is a young preacher boy. And they say, you know, back where we come from, we need somebody like you. And so they ask him to come to Piscataway, which is now what we call Dover. And they're asking him to come and to preach. And so he goes back and they start a church there. And he ministers there for the next 3 to 4 years, up to 1641. He's accused while he's there. During this time, even though the church itself really likes him, he's accused once again of antinomianism. He's accused of being an Anabaptist. And it seems like that everybody's against him. Then when it looks like he's going to make it through that, there's another guy who moves into town who's also a gifted preacher and comes in and starts helping him do the work in the church. And everything looks like it's pretty good until this guy, who has some real arrogant desires of his own to be the head man, basically tries to push Knollys out. And so there's a struggle that goes on, not just between these two men, but now between the congregation dividing over this. And it becomes such a degree of animosity here in the church that the courts have to step in and decide who's right and who's wrong. And eventually, Knollys comes out as being someone who's led a godly life and has done the right thing, but it still left some remaining issues there. And it looks like, once again, he's going to have to go be arrested and be thrown back into jail for these kinds of things. And he's been accused of a dalliance with a woman, which seems to be untrue according to the records, but he's been accused of it. So because of all these things, he feels pressure. And at the same time that all this is going on, he hears news about from his father that he needs to come back home because the father's very ill and needs him to come back home and take over the family. So in 1641, he leaves New England and goes back to London, arrives London 24th of December, for Christmas, 1641. And before I move out of New England, because there are a number of things that we could take time to deal with New England, the church that he is pastor of there in Dover, depending on how you look at it historically, is either the second or the third Baptist church in America. Roger Williams, then him. So he's really close, like a matter of like a year, less than a year, of being the first Baptist pastor in New England. So we have a lot to look at if we wanted to about his early ecclesiastical work there. But this is the very beginning of him as a Baptist. He hasn't really worked through a lot of his Baptist ecclesiology yet, but it remains that that's true. Secondly, you have people like Winthrop who doesn't really know how to view him. he looks at Winthrop looks at Nihilus and sees involved in all these things, like antinomianism possibly and Anabaptism possibly. But all of the legal records that come back to Winthrop say this is a really pious individual. He's a godly man. And so when you look at the journals of Winthrop, he actually calls him pious and venerable, which I find very interesting. You also have in the history books another very important New England person writing towards the end of Nihilus' life, looking back on past history of New England, and that's Cotton Mather. Mather had also heard about what was going on in the early days. He never met, we don't think or know that he met Nihilus. But when he writes about Nihilus, it's obviously that he didn't like him too much, because the nickname that he gives Hansard Nihilus is Absurd No Less. You got to love these guys. Absurd No Less. Love these things. But after calling him that, Mather called him a godly Anabaptist. So it's interesting to see how these people were viewing Nihilus in the other days. So Nihilus now leaves, gets back on the ship, goes the journey again with his wife. They get back over to London, almost Christmas 1641. He doesn't have any money. He's trying to take up and deal with things with his father and his family. So now he's got to have a livelihood. He's got to make some money. And so he depends once again, as he had done early on, teaching school. Did I say how bright he was? Did I say that he was a great linguist? Did I say that he was really good with Greek and Latin and Hebrew? He evidently was not as good with Hebrew as he wanted to be. So he meets a guy named Christian Ravis, who's a German from Berlin, and he learns Hebrew from him. And several years later, he actually writes one of the best Hebrew grammars of the 17th century. This is Nihilus does. So he wrote and published during this time and over the next 5 or 6 years, he wrote one of the best grammar books. He wrote one of the best language books on the Greek language. He writes one of the best language books on Latin, and he writes one of the best language books on Hebrew. So he gets this fantastic reputation for being a really good teacher and a very good linguist. When he first starts teaching school, he teaches at this one little school, and it's basically just taking a few students, and he's going to tutor some children of some wealthy peoples. He soon moves over into another school and gets about 60 students, scholars as they were called then. And then he runs out of room there again, so he moves to another building. And this time he gets up to 140 students. Now, that's pretty amazing on its own, especially within a year's period of time after coming back from England. So it's obviously this man had some real teaching gifts and a heart for children and wanting to educate them. A little bit later on in the life of Benjamin Keach, Keach is also involved in educating children and writes a primer that's very well used in England and also in New England, and Nihilus is one of the ones that writes the foreword to it. So there's a connection between these two things in the New England primer. So he is teaching away. It looks like everything's going along. And then you have civil war breaks out. You had had this horrible, bloody mess in Ireland. And the very next year, civil war begins in England. And everybody's taking one side or another. And Nihilus sides up with the parliamentary army. And he decides he's going to leave teaching and go be a chaplain with the parliamentary army. And so he does that. He's preaching regularly. But once again, he becomes disenchanted with the commanders, as he says, sought their own things more than the cause of God and his people, breaking their vows and solemn engagements. And so he eventually quits the army, goes back to London, and is trying to decide what he wants to do. Is again starts teaching school a little bit. But at this point, he's really beginning to work through some of the Baptist issues in his mind. This is also 1644. What happens in 1644 for Baptists? It's the first London Baptist Confession of Faith. Now, he doesn't sign that. He does sign the revised version in 1646, just a couple years later. But in 1644, he's there, and he starts attending an independent church, which is called the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Independent Church. And if you know anything about your Baptist history, it's out of that group that the first couple of really strong particular Baptist churches begin to develop. And it's primarily because Nollis, along with Jesse and Lathrop and Jacob, Nollis begins to question some of the things that are going on in the independent church, especially infant baptism. It's not a Baptist church yet, it's just an independent church that's allowing infant baptism. Nollis begins to question this and so says, hey, can we have some meetings to discuss this matter and see what the scriptures really say? And he ends up convincing a number of the men, including Jesse, whom he baptizes, so that there's the beginning of these early particular Baptistic churches. Now, that's a very important matter in Baptist history, because this is now the beginning of something that is going to really grow really fast through the labors of people like Hansard Nollis and William Kiffin, who become really strong friends and are probably the two most influential Baptists to see a lot of things go on. Ecclesiologically speaking, they're involved in doing things like church planning from now on, as well as developing their own churches and evangelizing different areas of the country. I'm going to come back to that in just a few moments. So, 1644, Nollis and his friend and future fellow Baptist, William Kiffin, initiate this discussion on baptism. 1644, March, Kiffin withdraws and forms his own church. In 1645, this particular Baptist church is really organized, and the first location of it is in the heart of London, right next to Great St. Helens. And if you know anything about Great St. Helens, it was one of the biggest of the churches there. And this was basically right next door to Great St. Helens, with Nollis as a pastor. It grows, his Baptist church grows so fast that they have to relocate. And during that time between the 1640s and 1650s, just like I mentioned with Keach last night, having a church of about 1,000 people, at this point, Nollis' church gets up to over 1,000 people. And this is before what happens with Keach. This doesn't happen for Keach for a number of years, but this is like the first Baptistic church that has tremendous following of people coming on a regular basis to hear the gospel. In addition to his pastoral duties at this point, Nollis begins writing and debating in defense of Baptist doctrines, as Nettle says, as well as engaging in and supporting various missionary efforts in England and Wales. He would go around to different places in England and do church plants. Yeah, he went into Wales and once again was there to evangelize and to see a church planted. His church was sending out other people in other areas of England to see church plants take place. This is all the beginnings of early particular Baptist churches. And if you want to do a study of missiology for early Baptists, this is a really exciting time, because this is the beginning of some really fast emerging growth among particular Baptists. Yes, particular Baptists were evangelistic and mission-minded, and it's pretty amazing to see what all was taking place. One of the most significant contributions during this time is part of his writing, and it comes in the form of two treatises that are published, one engaging the Presbyterian John Bastwick concerning congregational government, independency, and congregationalism, and the other engaging the independent John Saltmarsh concerning believers' baptism. Both of these are really important treatises. The first one is called A Moderate Answer unto Dr. Bastwick's book called Independency Not God's Ordinance. In response to Bastwick's Independency Not God's Ordinance, or a treatise concerning church government occasioned by the distractions of these times. So in this book, and Buston in his work deals with this quite extensively, he's dealing with the problem of independency and congregationalism, and he's showing how it should be done right. Knowledge is. And he's really dealing with Bastwick's opinions that are wrong. He also shows his classical learning in his arguments against Bastwick. And I mention this because in my own life, I taught in a classical school for 7 years, and I helped develop the curriculum for logic and rhetoric in those schools. And I know how important it is to teach, to reason well and to think well and to communicate well. And this was certainly something that was part of Knowles' life. And so Buston notes that Knowles' familiarity with the conventions of scholarly syllogistic debate was clearly evident in this work. In fact, Knowles was critical of what he believed to be Bastwick's poor debating skills. Quote, "For if the doctor please to review his argument, he shall find first that the subject of his major proposition is left out both in his minor and in his conclusion. The first part of the doctor's minor should have been this, to wit, but the apostles in the Holy Scripture are called presbyters, and whoever denied this. Also, the first part of the doctor's conclusion should have been this. From these two premises, to wit, ergo, the apostles acted as presbyters, which conclusion is not the thing in question." I'm sure you got all that. But the point is, he was a very fine debater. He used academic logic, classical logic, to answer his opponents, and he almost always won. I have not been able to find at any time that he debated anybody that ever lost the debate in any of the debates that he had. That's pretty amazing. The second treatise was a thing in response to Saltmarsh's book, which was called The Smoke in the Temple, wherein is a design for peace and reconciliation of believers of the several opinions of these times about ordinances to a forbearance of each other in love and meekness and humility. It was kind of a conciliatory article by a book by Saltmarsh that was written, but it ended up saying some things that was just wrong. It had a conciliatory tone, but it ended up defeating some of the things that should have been dealt with. And so Knowles writes a book in response to that called The Shining of a Flaming Fire in Zion. And in that, he ends up dealing very forcefully with the arguments that Saltmarsh puts forth. And once again, he wins the day. It's an amazing article there. And again, Buston deals with this pretty extensively. Nettle says it is clear that Knowles was well-equipped academically, theologically, and spiritually for leadership in a new ecclesiological option that was certain to attract literal opposition and physical persecution. The fledgling particular Baptist movement needed such stable, courageous, long-term leadership. He remained part of his London church until his death in 1691. And Nettle says in the 93rd year of his age, too. So I'll let you work with Nettles on that. So during this time, there's a time of really starting to debate issues, primarily over baptism or independency. He begins also writing and dealing with infant baptism with groups of people. So he would join with people like Benjamin Cox, who we now know much more about in the last 30 years, and with William Kiffin. And they are dealing with they want to deal with some people like Edmund Calamy and the Presbyterians. And so they set up a time to be able to debate the things, and the mayor of London cancels the debate. You know, it's going to really create some friction. And so it doesn't stop the particular Baptists from publishing their arguments that they were going to give. And it's a very powerful little work, a declaration concerning the public dispute, which should have been in the public meeting house of Alderman Berry, the third of this instant month of December, concerning infant baptism, together with some of the arguments which should then have been propounded and urged by some of those that are falsely called Anabaptists, which should then have been disputed. You've got to love these titles. So all this dispute never occurred. A year later, in 1646, a similar debate took place at Trinity Church between Austin Kiffin and the Reverend John Bryan, vicar of Trinity Church, and the Reverend Obadiah Grew, vicar of St. Michael's, Coventry. It's significant, according to Buston, that both of their opponents were well-educated ministers within the established church. And he says, certainly Knowles' Cambridge education and previous clerical experience made him a valuable asset to the particular Baptists in these disputations. So once again, he was winning the arguments all along. Church is beginning to grow voraciously. Seems like all the right kinds of things are happening. He has incredible opportunities to preach in other places. In 1645, he goes to preach in another place. And he preaches a sermon, actually a set of sermons, but the first sermon is on Christ exalted. Remember I said that's part of our title. I'll come back to this once again, Lord willing, here at the end. In that book, he is clearly preaching the gospel. Nothing but preaching the gospel. It's actually an exposition, partially, of Colossians 3 about Christ, Colossians about Christ is all and in all. It's a fantastic sermon. And as he's preaching, he's stoned in the pulpit. People out in the pulpit don't want to hear the gospel from what they consider is an antinomian and an Anabaptist, although he's not. And so they begin to stone him. It causes such an uproar that the police have to step in. And people are arrested, and he's brought before the courts and has to prove that he's not an antinomian or an Anabaptist. And he says, well, how would you like to prove it? And they said, well, why don't you preach to us what you preach? And so he re-preaches portions of the sermons to them, and he's released because they can't find anything wrong. And so what does he do? He publishes the sermons. And that's why we have Christ exalted as one of these great sermons that he preaches that is now published and becomes one of his best known sermons. Christ exalted, and here's the subtitle, a lost sinner sought and saved by Christ. God's people are a holy people, being the sum of diverse sermons preached in Suffolk. He says, when he publishes this in the preface to the work, he says, my main endeavors there was to exalt Christ and to press my hearers to sanctification in heart and life. That's why he preached. And yet he was arrested, brought before the courts, but they couldn't find anything wrong. That also becomes a pattern from him. That it seems like every time that he's brought before the courts, in his defense, he always glorifies Christ, and he's always set free, or he's always exonerated in the outcome. I think that's a sweet testimony to the integrity of this man and of the gifts and abilities of Knowles. So now we're up to the later 1640, 1645, 46, 47, along in that time period. 1646, as I mentioned, is the year that is the revision of the London Baptist Confession. He is one of the signers now of that because he's becoming one of the leaders of the particular Baptists, and his name goes on that list, and he's in full agreement with what is being proclaimed in the first London Confession. He also lives to be old enough to sign the second one. He is actually one of the ones who has it written out in 1677, and then in 1689 he's still around when it's actually published to the world. So pretty amazing man to have lived through both of those opportunities and to have been involved with both of those confessions. He's now at this point becoming a real statesman and becoming a real leader among the particular Baptists. He's even getting authorized by Parliament to go to some of the other areas in England and to preach. Now, to help you understand this, not only has he become the pastor of one of the largest, fastest growing churches among nonconformists in London, in the center of London, that would be enough, but he also is bivocational. And the works that he's doing are pretty amazing. He's called upon to work for the office of the examiner of customs, making a pretty good amount of money. Then he becomes clerk of the Navy, and you know how big the British Navy was at that point, and he basically has the registers of everybody that's in the Navy. So this was not just some illiterate, crazy, nonconformist person. This is a Cambridge-educated, classical language teacher, preacher, who is also able to do things at a public level and an official level and is called upon by the government to do so. You get a little bit better picture of this guy? This is not just some nobody. This is someone with really some a really set of great gifts and abilities that God is using in a pretty amazing way. The very next year, 1665, the plague hits. We talked about that last night. It's hard for us to even imagine how destructive the plague was, how many people died. It would have been really easy at this point for him to take his family and to leave. But he doesn't. He stays and he ministers to those who are diseased and dying. And he stays the whole time. That's an amazing testimony to the character and integrity of this man. He's, at this point, if it's the 60s, he's at least 50 years old, if not 60, depending on how you age it. 50 years old at that point was really old. A lot of people didn't live past 52 or 3. If you made it to 60, you were a really old man. Keach made it to 64. He was an old man. This guy, depending on which timetable you go by, is either 93 or 83 when he dies. That's ancient when he dies. So at this point, he's in what is that everybody would have been normally thinking is probably the last days of his life. And the end part of the 60s, 1665 to 1670, you just can't even imagine. If I had time to just tell you all the things that he did during those 5 years, we'd be here for another hour. Just simply to reference what all he was involved in. All the ordinations of other ministers, writing books. He was writing books about the exposition of the book of Revelation, because during this time period, the eschatological movement is moving fast. You've got the Catholics that are trying to come back in and take control of the country. You've got the Protestants trying to hold on. Not just the Baptists, not just any of the other nonconformists, but all Reformed groups of people were thinking this is probably the end times. And so everybody was writing these eschatological works, expecting Christ to return at any moment. Nahus is certainly one of those. He writes a number of things related to the book of Revelation, related to Mystery Babylon Unveiled is the title of one of them. And he even thinks that he's got it worked out which year Christ is coming back. Unfortunately, he lives past that date, so he sees that that's wrong. This was not uncommon for people during this time period. It was also that millennial fervor was also part of what were called the Fifth Monarchy men. And many people try to put Nahus as a member or involved in the Fifth Monarchy men. I think it's been proven by both Howson and by Buston that even though he had some tendencies towards that, he differed drastically with what their key things were, and he never seems to be involved in any of their major things, even though he's accused at times of being one. But this, because of this millennial fervor, because he's writing commentaries on the book of Revelation, because he's writing things that are very antagonistic against the Roman Catholics, like Mystery Babylon Unveiled, because he's saying to the congregations, come out from Babylon. So that's a reference to the Catholics. Come out from your false religion and come and understand the gospel. So it's a spiritual thing that's motivating him to see people come to Christ and to come out of false religions. And that's pushing him in his millennial views. This is all in the end of the 1600s. This leads up to 1689, when the 1689 confession now can be published and is. And he's one of the signers of that and one of the ones that gets it published around the country and distributed around the country. Now republished, if you will. He heads the list of signers in its support. So now we're at the very end of his life. All right. He dies in 1691. 1689, he's an ancient man. He still is involved in all kinds of ordinations of young men coming into the ministry. He sees that as one of the things that he really needs to be involved in, is training up future generations. And the list of men that he's involved in the ordination process is like a who's who of the next generation of particular Baptist ministers. Enough on that, again, would be a whole other session with us. 1690, he is commending the works of Tobias Chris, who was involved with antinomianism, but was always cleared of those charges. He writes a commendatory preface to the republishing of Chris' work during this time. So once again, he's labeled an antinomian. 1690, you've got a number of things politically going on, and he's involved in a lot of that. The end of 1690 and 1690, the first part of 1691, is the thing we referenced last night with Keats, the hymn singing controversy. That one is at its height. And Nahlas was a friend of Keach's, and agreed with Keach for congregation hymn singing to be developed. His co-pastor in his church, Robert Steed, was one of the ones who helped be the opposition. So in your own church, your younger co-pastor is creating problems about this controversial debate, and you're the older, wiser guy that's saying, no, this is right. And the younger guy is saying, no, we've got to stand against this. And so there's so much division there that it almost splits the church, only because of the wisdom and the godliness of Nahlas does the church really stay together. And it seems like that Steed kind of backs off, even though he's still a member of the church and still preaching some. When you look at the last thing that Nahlas writes, which is a legacy comment, one of the things that he pleads for is for Steed basically to repent and to come back and to be involved like he used to be at the level of godliness that he used to be. So it's an older, godly, caring Paul to a Timothy saying, please come back and do what you're supposed to be doing. That's part of his last will and testament, if you will, which again speaks to the integrity of this man. So the beginning part of 1691, that's going on. That's the last year of his life. And he's involved in so many more ordinations and so many more things. Again, we couldn't mention all of these things. 1691 is the year of his death. So on September the 19th, after attending the subsequent London assemblies of 1690-1691, he died in his late in life. This commentator says his life represents that of a prominent 17th century particular Baptist leader who endured the persecution of the era with perseverance and devotion to the Baptist cause. He's buried in Bunhill Fields. Now, one of the things that I tried to reference was all the times he was imprisoned. And yet every time he's exonerated. And if you read through his autobiography, he views these, he'll talk about all the times he's in prison, but then he'll always put in parentheses, thank God for prison mercies. Would you be able to do that? And, you know, prison was not easy back then. And also when you read in the autobiography and even some of these other reports, it will talk about the time that he spent in prison. He was always preaching. And he was catechizing. And he was spending time giving comfort and care to those who were in real need in the prison. And he was seeing people come to faith in Christ while they're in prison. And so he really did believe that God would put him in prison sometimes. And while he was there, he needed to honor God, and he thanked God for these prison mercies that he received to be able to work while he was in there. What I didn't mention is part of the providential workings in his life. I mentioned how he lost his first child on the way over to New England. When he comes back, he's got a couple more children. Before it's all over with, he ends up with three or four boys and three daughters. All but one daughter dies in the 1670s. His wife dies. All of his sons die one by one. Two of the daughters die. There's only one that remains that ends up helping him late in life. It's hard to lose your child, anybody to lose their child. He lost all but one, and he loses his wife. And that's in the 1670s, and he makes it to 91. So he's still got a long time to continue to minister and yet to grieve. And yet, as he would want to grieve, and it would be fine to grieve, he gives thanks to God for the mercies and the grace that God gives him during this time. When you read his autobiography, you're overwhelmed with how often he's given thanks and praise to God for the sweet providences of the Lord. So that's the life and that's the labors. He wrote almost 25 works. Many of those have to do with eschatological themes, and we can learn lessons from those kinds of things. We can learn not to pick dates. But most of the people, especially most of the 21st century scholars that deal with him on eschatological things, say that he was a historicist in his views. But most of the time, his applications are all spiritual. And that's a difficult line to walk, because there's a temptation, if you want to deal with eschatological things the way a lot of dispensationalists deal with now, you're not really dealing with spiritual matters. It's all about emotional things. Nahus always kept laboring for spiritual concerns. I think we can learn from that. And that's why almost all of these guys will say it's unfair to judge him as either a fifth monarchy man or a millennialist and try to apply to him some things that are not true. He always keeps things on a godly keel. It's wrong to view him as an antinomian. It's wrong to view him as a hyper-Calvinist, although he was a high Calvinist. It's wrong to view him as an anti-Baptist, even though he was definitely a particular Baptist. And some of these works go to great length. In fact, that's some of the whole purpose of their writings, is to show what kind of man he was, even though he was accused of all these things of his life and was even imprisoned for these things that he was accused of. He always remained a person of integrity, and they could never make these things be true of him. He always was exonerated, always comes out on the top. It's because of that kind of integrity and godliness that he exercised, as well as the tireless work and ministry that he's involved in throughout his harried life. And you see now why I use that term, because it definitely was a life that was harassed and harried. Throughout all that life, he glorifies God. And he's used to see the gospel spread as an evangelist and as a missionary and as a church planner And as a pastor that grew a very large, maybe one of the largest churches among Baptists in the 17th century, as a polemicist, as a controversialist, as just a very fine writer, as a publisher of academic books that helped in education, where he publishes books, grammars on Latin and Greek and Hebrew. This was a man that was especially gifted by God for the 17th century and for the building up of the particular Baptists in the 17th century. And it's why we need to pay attention to this man, Hansard Knox. He was not absurd, no less. Yeah, he was Hansard Knox, and we need to be thankful for him. When you look at his theology, and I'll close with this today, he did have an evangelistic Calvinism. It's very much rooted in a covenant theology. He makes comments about how he was also saved by an understanding of a covenant of grace. Just the same kind of statement I read from Keach last night. Most seems like they said the same thing. Because that was what was influencing the minds of these young particular Baptists, and it affected him the rest of his life. He was very much involved in the ecclesiology for Baptists, in writing against people who are misinterpreting independency and trying to write and deal with congregationalism the way it should be. He was involved in Baptistic controversies, where he was helping this fledgling group of nonconformists who were Baptistic. He was helping to make a name for them in a way that elevated who they were instead of them making them look like buffoons. Here was an educated, Cambridge-bred, brilliant debater of his age who could stand for the truths of the gospel and come out on top and be a person of integrity as he did so. And that helped the cause of Baptists to look like they were important people. He also was involved in the revision of the 1644 confessions and 1646 first confession, and he was involved in the writing and the distribution and the republishing of what we call the 1689 confession. So once again, he's involved in making sure that Baptists are thought of as good guys and not the bad guys. These are not Anabaptists. These are not antinomians. These are not people that we shouldn't pay attention to. But these are faithful brothers who are preaching the gospel and are standing for the sake of Christ and don't mind being persecuted for what they do. And for those reasons, we need to pay attention to Hansard Knox. He was involved in issues about the Lord's Supper that I didn't even touch on. He was involved in issues about Seventh-day Sabbatarianism. He was involved in the worship controversies about singing in public worship. He was involved in issues about spiritual gifts, which I didn't even go into. Michael Haken has a wonderful article on his understanding of spiritual gifts that goes right along with the confessional statement. All of these things, he comes across as Orthodox, Trinitarian, Baptistic. And he is truly one of the best of the particular Baptist pioneers in 17th century England. And we need to recognize this man for he is. And I close with the title again. It's all because he wanted to see Christ exalted, no matter how harried his life was. Thanks be to God that he raises up such men for the glory of God, for the advancement of his kingdom, and for the edification of his people. Thank you.